Hello, and welcome to the Responsive Family Sleep Podcast. I'm your host, Kim Hawley, holistic sleep coach, lactation consultant, peaceful parenting educator, and mom. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by all the conflicting sleep info, frustrated with sleep information that just plain felt wrong, or searched desperately for a truly gentle and responsive sleep approach, then you are in the right place. In each episode, we'll be answering your most pressing baby and toddler sleep questions, busting those sleep myths, and helping you understand truly developmental, biologically normal baby and toddler sleep, plus encouraging you to trust your intuition along the way. Let's get started. Hello, and welcome back. This week, I am joined by a colleague, a new friend of mine, Jenna, who is a lactation counselor as well as parenting coach. And she supports parents who are nursing toddlers and beyond for natural term nursing and just navigating that experience and that journey. And we connected and, you know, I love supporting nursing toddler families from a sleep and lactation perspective. And she loves supporting nursing toddler families from a parenting, coaching, lactation perspective. And we were like, oh my gosh, we have to talk. This is amazing. We need to be business friends. And so I hope you enjoy our conversation. And we are really just focusing on the joys and challenges of nursing toddlers. And I figured since I support a lot of families nursing toddlers that you would enjoy this conversation as well.
All right, let's jump in. So Jenna, I'm so excited to have you here with me today. I would love to start our conversation off with you sharing a little bit about how you got into supporting parents of nursing toddlers and that lovely, you know, full-term nursing journey.
Absolutely. So starting with myself, when I was being breastfed, I was breastfed into toddlerhood. My mom's always fuzzy on exactly when we weaned, but me and my two siblings were both breastfed past a year. So for me growing up, it was kind of normal. It was like, yeah, well, it's normal to breastfeed a two-year-old. That wasn't something that was really foreign or strange to me. So when I was coming time to have my own children, I just assumed that I would breastfeed into toddlerhood. And, you know, my mom is a labor doula. So I was around birth a lot, natural birth world. So in the natural birth Facebook groups, all of that stuff, right? So planning so much around my birthing experience and having a lot of knowledge around that, as well as a lot of expectations, which things don't always go to plan, of course, but something that I didn't realize that I would need to prepare for would be breastfeeding. I just kind of assumed that it was going to be natural and normal and it would just happen. And that was that. But because my mom was a doula, when I was in the preparation of, you know, preparing for the birth of my daughter, I came across a local prenatal breastfeeding class. And I thought my mom needed to get some more, you know, continuing education type credits. And I was like, cool, let's do this together. We'll take this class. And my mind was just like blown. I was like, what? This is crazy. There's so much more to this than I ever thought. And I was really, really excited for breastfeeding from that standpoint. And then when my daughter was born, I had some birth trauma. There was some things that happened that weren't awesome. And then after she was born, she didn't latch for 3 days. So it was hard, right? I was equipped. I was like, I knew what to do. I knew I needed to hand express, syringe feed. It was kind of like, this is difficult, but we got this. Plus, I'd taken this class with a local lactation consultant. And so I had the people in my corner. I knew who to call. And after we got a tongue and lip tie, you know, diagnosis and then release, we were off to the races, right? And so things started going more smoothly. I started to notice, though, that my friends were running into very similar challenges that I was when they would give birth, which, you know, I had a friend who had a child about 3 months after I had my first, and she was sent home from the hospital with formula. And she was having the exact same issues that I was. And I was like, wait, what's happening here? Like, why are you having this outcome? And I had this outcome, but we like had the exact same kind of problems, symptoms, right, that were coming up. And so I remember going to her house and only having had like, you know, this few hours of education that I had had in this breastfeeding class, but I was able to help her a lot. And she ended up also having a tongue-tied baby, which, like I said, it was like textbook. We were both having the exact same challenges. So it's so strange. So I was able to support her. And then I was kind of hooked on breastfeeding support after that. And I remember just my little baby and me driving around in my car, going to my friends' houses after they'd have a baby. And I'd drop off some food and they'd be like, have questions. And I was in there, right? And like, it wasn't like I was like this expert, but I had some information and education and I had a lot of resources. So I was able to, you know, say, this is normal. This isn't normal. I experienced this too. Reach out to these people. Right. So from there, I moved into becoming a lactation counselor, getting my certification in that. And, you know, we're trucking along with the breastfeeding journey, right? Like we had all these troubles at the beginning. We're like, all right, we got this. And then I'm like, let's have another baby. Sounds great. Right. And as soon as I got pregnant, I got slammed with nursing aversion, which I had no idea what that was. But suddenly I just had this crazy urge to just shove my daughter off of me as soon as she would latch. And it was scary. I was like the expert, quotes. I was the expert, right? I was the one that people were turning to, and I didn't know what this was. I didn't have the words for it. I didn't know how to deal with it. And I thought, like, I had read Adventures in Tandem Nursing. I thought that I could, well, I hadn't read it all at that point, but I had gotten the book. I was like, I'm going to do this.
First step.
Yeah. I don't think because I remember not knowing what nursing aversion was. And I know that Hilary Flowers talks about it in that book. So I don't think that I had read that piece at that point, but I was excited about it, right? Like I was moving in that direction. And I just didn't know what those challenges would be there. I didn't know it was still going to be this hard. I really had high hopes for what my breastfeeding journey would be the second time around because I struggled so much in the beginning. And so I was like, here, now I can, you know, I can help myself more, right? Like it's going to be different. And I remember in those early stages with my daughter talking about sleep and stuff like that, but I had had a lot of understanding of what was normal, but I still kind of had this internal conflict a lot, right? So I would swaddle her and stick her in the bassinet beside the bed every night, and she'd end up in our bed. But I still tried. I tried to have her separate every night. So I knew that one time my son came around, I was like, nope, he's coming right into the bed from the very beginning, and that's that. And so I was like, it's going to be so much easier, right? And then of course there was all of these new challenges that I had, and I learned. So I kind of mentioned that I'd had this birth trauma with my daughter. And so that was being triggered when I was pregnant, not gave birth, but when I got pregnant with my son, I started to have to confront a lot of those challenges that I had then and things that I just kind of swept under the rug and said, you know, it's okay. I'll deal with this later almost. Right. It was like, and this is when these things are bubbling up. And so at that point, I really started learning more and more about nervous system regulation. And I learned that my nursing aversion had a lot more to do with my internal sense of safety and danger. And when you're having PTSD and flashbacks and all of those things and not being able to sleep at night because of nightmares, and that wasn't really about the breastfeeding experience at all. It was showing up in my breastfeeding experience, but it wasn't a result of my breastfeeding experience. It was actually me and my journey that I was going on. So I learned how to support my daughter. I learned how to support myself. My daughter would also have epic meltdowns at age 2, 3. And now that I understand that I have ADHD and she likely does as well, neurodivergence, there's sensory pieces, you know, she was not an easy sleeper at all. Of course, I didn't really know.
I'm nodding because I've been there too.
Yeah. So breastfeeding was the only thing that would calm her down in a meltdown. And I remember wrestling with this, like, but I need to have more tools. We need to support her in other ways. I can't only rely on breastfeeding, you know, had that narrative in my mind. So there's all of these different stressors that were kind of there. And slowly I worked through these things. And by the time my son was born, and of course I had therapists, I had all the things I was working through. I was learning as much as I could. I had done a lot of studying of psychology when I was in university. So I already had a good understanding of a lot of things So I was able to look now at just current research, and I was able to look at, you know, read the books and have a more of a baseline to build off of. And so just continuing to learn about those things, polyvagal theory, you know, I love Dr. Dan Siegel's like interpersonal neurobiology. So I was just eating it all up. And then I was really putting it into practice with my own kids. So we went on to breastfeed. My daughter weaned at age 6, and we breastfed for 3 years, or tandem fed for over 3 years. My son is still breastfeeding. He'll be 4 very soon. And what I found was everywhere I went, there would be people that in conversation, it would kind of come out that I did lactation support, you know, just naturally it would come out. And then they would kind of get this look and they dip their toe and be like, yeah, I breastfed. Oh, I'm still breastfeeding. And it would kind of like come out that they were breastfeeding their 2-year-old, their 3-year-old, their 4-year-old. And it was always like this hesitation that was there. Mm-hmm. And once I was like, oh, me too. I know. I gotcha. Right. And I could start sharing just a little bit of my story. There was all of this stuff that would come tumbling out. They would have nursing aversion. They would have sleep issues. They would have all these things, but they had nowhere to turn to for support. Because most of the time, myself included, hey, I was breastfed till I was 2, but my mom did not know how to help me tandem feeding or how to help me when I'm talking about issues breastfeeding my 3-year-old or my 4-year-old, because she didn't breastfeed that long, right? I was the first one that I knew personally to do that. So where do you turn for support, right? And a lot of people that I would bump into were in a very similar situation. So it didn't take too long for me to realize, okay, I really want to focus on toddler breastfeeding and weaning and tandem feeding support, because as much as we talk about there being a lack of support for newborn breastfeeding, and there is, don't get me wrong, a lot of people don't have the resources, don't know where to reach out. They have all those cultural influences, all those things. It is even more so once you hit that 1, 2, 3 years. Then in the States recently, it was just last year, the American Academy of Pediatrics, you know, increased the recommendation from 1 year to 2 years. So great. Now we're telling people they need to breastfeed for longer and not telling them how to do that or what that looks like, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of pushback, a lot of grumpy people, right? Because that support isn't there. I mean, it's not even there from the beginning, let alone to, you know, match our guidelines to the World Health Organization's guidelines.
Yeah. I mean, in Canada, we'd had it for a long time. So that was always the Canadian Pediatric Society. Well, as long as I had been breastfeeding, it was the Canadian Pediatric Society's recommendation. So I always felt justified in my, you know, I was like, well, that's what, you know, even when the pediatrician would say something silly to me about not needing to breastfeed my 15-month-old, I would say, well, you're not listening to your own governing body's like recommendations.
So true.
That's actually, you know, like you're, So I felt confident in that, but then I did see all of that pushback too. Like it was just last year. So just to watch all that unfold online, it was just another very clear sign that I was doing what needed, like a fulfilling a very necessary role, you know, in the parenting journey.
I mean, so I was nursed till I was 3. And I got lots of stories about that growing up. My sister self-weaned around 1. So when my oldest was a toddler, I nursed both my kiddos till they were 4. And I remember being like, you know, backing up, I entered lactation support through the Leche League. So nursing toddlers were very much part of, or, you know, always part of the Leche League culture and meetings and conversation and support. But I, having that in that setting was not the same as having like more day-to-day support. Like I didn't have any friends nursing toddlers. And I distinctly remember the first time I was like, I'm going to search on Facebook for a Facebook group about nursing toddlers. I end up in this predominantly UK-based nursing older babies and toddlers group. And I was like, oh my God, my people, like that ability to get that, you know, support. I wasn't even having issues. It was more just like, I feel like I'm the only one doing this. It'd be kind of nice not to feel like I'm the only one doing this. Was really powerful. And then by the time my daughter's born, I'm like, whatever, like been there, done that. You know, I don't really need anyone's support in the same way because it wasn't new. I mean, support is always good, but that well, need wasn't
sometimes
there.
You do face new challenges with another nursling.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes you don't. And so, you know, it gets valid.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, I think that like nursing toddlers is like my happy place in lactation as well. That's why when I first stumbled across you. I was like, oh my God, we're the same, except we're approaching it from different, totally different backgrounds and perspectives and stuff. But like, this is like my happy place. I love the nursing toddlers and work with a lot of them when it comes to sleep. And so, you know, I feel like personally and professionally, and I'm sure you agree that like nursing full term, nursing toddlers, nursing past one, you know, it comes with so many positives and also so many challenges that, like you said, really can blindside you. So you mentioned a few of those challenges in your story. So I thought we could talk a little bit about, you know, some of the common challenges and then kind of turn the corner around to some of the really lovely ways that nursing can be a wonderful parenting tool in the toddler years.
Absolutely. So a lot of times the things that people face are things like, you know, of course there's sleep, right? So yeah. A child, but the 18 month old that's still waking multiple times a night to breastfeed can feel challenging, especially when you're in a culture and a world and even just a family group and a friend group where that's not happening. You can feel like you're definitely the odd man out, and it can definitely feel like you're not allowed to share certain aspects of your life and your parenting with your friends. Like those certain things have to be off topic, like off limits, which can feel difficult. That can be a hard and challenging place to be.
Yeah.
And then there's things like nipple twiddling, which, you know, you don't get with a newborn as much. It can definitely start to happen in early babyhood too, but it can happen. Yeah. In older babies and then into toddlerhood, nipple twiddling is a big one that drives a lot of parents really crazy. But even things like your period being delayed can feel difficult. It can feel scary, especially if you are hoping to conceive another baby soon and you're going on 12, 14 months without a period, or maybe you've had periods, but they're very irregular. And you're getting pressure from, you know, a lot of times parents will bring this up with their family doctor. And of course, because it is so culturally not normal to breastfeed at that stage, a lot of times family doctors don't know what to do with that information. So they might just recommend going on birth control. They might recommend weaning. They might even run some diagnostic tests, which I'm not saying that they should or they shouldn't, but it's not normal, or it's not abnormal or wrong or bad for you to not have a period at 12 months if you're still breastfeeding a toddler. So you don't have to worry that there's inherently something wrong with your body because of that. Even up to age two, it's normal. And unfortunately, simply because we don't have a ton of research around breastfeeding dyads past that first year of life, particularly past that second year of life, it's difficult to know from the research what is truly normal and what isn't normal. And even a lot of times in more alternative medicine approaches, hormonal testing and all that kind of stuff, they won't even do if you're still breastfeeding because we don't have baselines for it. We don't, you know, there's all that kind of stuff too. So it can be a challenge.
And experientially, there's such a wide range of normal, return of fertility.
Of course.
Yeah.
And there are things that you can do, and that's a different conversation, but there are things that you can do to optimize your chances of having your fertility return without fully weaning. That's absolutely viable. Many people go on to get pregnant without having to do anything. So, you know, just as a listener who may be concerned about this listening, you know, it's very likely that you can get pregnant without having to do any kind of intentional changes in your breastfeeding journey too. But that's one of the things that can come up as like a sticky spot. And then of course, like we talked about nursing aversion, you feel really big. Then there are all of that behavioral pieces where people can feel that their child is too attached or clingy to them because they're breastfeeding. There's the voices of you shouldn't be breastfeeding anymore. This is the reason why your child, you know, is having a hard time transitioning to daycare, won't stay with a sitter, you know, why you can't have a night apart from your spouse. All of these kinds of stories and narratives we can have internally, but we can often hear externally as well, that make the toddler breastfeeding experience feel particularly challenging.
I find that nursing, right from newborn all the way up, like into the toddler years, it is such a scapegoat for everything. Yes. That it may or may not have anything to do with, right? Like baby only wants mom, baby doesn't want to go to grandma who they've never met before, or like, you know, they're clingy because every separation is like, clearly it's because of nursing, or like, you know, they're having trouble with this, clearly it's because they're nursing. It's like, no, nursing has nothing to do with that.
I say that all the time. Breastfeeding isn't the problem. That's mm-hmm. not the problem here. And we can prove that. Like, we can prove that breastfeeding is not a problem. There's mm-hmm. never a time where we can say conclusively, breastfeeding has caused all of these problems in mm-hmm. your life. Breastfeeding is a way of getting needs met. It's a tool. Yep. You know, yep. we start out in that newborn days as it's the all-in-one tool. It does everything. Mm-hmm. You know, we can talk about ecological breastfeeding. And from that perspective, all you need to do is keep your baby on you and breastfeed, and all of your baby's needs are going to get met from day one. And then it's a slow transition, like after that, to introducing new tools, and that mm-hmm. will happen quite naturally. I remember you mentioned the Leche League, but I do remember being in a Leche League meeting with my daughter when she was just a couple months old, and the Leche League leader, she was older, she had adult children, and I remember her talking about her toddler breastfeeding experience like so plainly, just like matter-of-factly, like, yeah, this is just like normal, you know? And she talked about like, you don't need to be intentional with weaning, because life will be life will provide opportunities where separation's just going to have to happen. You don't need to artificially create that in order to create the separation. It's just going to happen. And so I was kind of privileged to be able to go into my experience having had that perspective very early on. And I remember she was just like, yeah, you know, you might hit that 24 month and they start breastfeeding some more. And then it kind of goes away. And then you hit like, you know, 2.5 and they breastfeed a little bit more. And there's all these, like, you know, how it ebbs and flows. And so it was really great to have had that perspective. But that's not the case for so many, right? They come in and it feels like breastfeeding is the problem. So when breastfeeding is a problem, weaning becomes the solution, at least in our minds. And that's what we wrestle with.
Yeah. And I just want to pull out two things that you said. I love like the ebbs and flows, right? Because just like sleep, feeding journeys kind of ebb and flow and go through different phases where they want to nurse more, they want to nurse less. Like, that is such a normal part of nursing, you know, into the toddler years. And, you know, those societal messages that really do create nursing is a problem, when it's like so many of these other things are just moving pieces around that nursing relationship. And the nursing relationship obviously creates a lot of connection between nursing parent and child, but it's not that doesn't mean that other people don't have an entry into like creating those bonds 100%. And those relationships and navigating those experiences. It's just we aren't very skilled as a society at looking at them that way. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of structural, cultural things that make it harder sometimes, and that kind of put nursing dyads together and then don't give us the right structure to have those kind of rich dynamic relationships that make it easier to like say, hey, my partner can put my kiddo to sleep even though I'm still nursing to sleep, right? Yep. Those types of things that we sometimes be like, I can't because of nursing. It's like, no, we just need to find another entry point. We just find another way of thinking about it.
We know from like attachment, like science and research, which has been around for well over 50, 60 years. Yeah. Like it's not a newfangled thing. Like, I know attachment parenting can feel newer, but even that has been around as a term since like the 90s. So it's
I'm making
new.
A face over here because I feel like attachment parenting is so loaded with like fears and like,
totally.
Then I'm like, I almost purposely don't use it. I use responsive parenting.
100%. I only use it because people relate to it. They feel like that's often a phrase that they've come into with. But I so get it. I never identified as that either. The attachment research has shown that the more secure attachment relationships a child has, the better. Mm-hmm. That's good for them. Mm-hmm. Now, they typically aren't able to develop new attachment relationships in meaningful ways until like 9 months or so. But when that time comes, and I don't mean that another person can't help, I just mean that child doesn't fully recognize and form that attachment as its own unique entity until a little bit further on in babyhood. So it makes sense that mom is primarily the one who's able to support them in many ways early on in their life. But those relationships and those attachment relationships that they create don't compete with each other, and they're mm-hmm. unique. They have their own unique expressions. So I often say that breastfeeding is actually a trait of the relationship you have with your child. It's not a yeah. trait that the child has themselves. I mean, sure, we can call them a breastfed child, but it's actually a relationship trait. So it's the way mm-hmm. that I support my child in these moments, but my husband has his own unique relationship with his child, who is also my child, and he's going to have his own unique ways of navigating that relationship and their own unique bonds. And it doesn't compete with what I have to offer. And what I have to offer doesn't compete with what he has to offer.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that sometimes we really aren't able to separate that. And I mean, that to no fault of anyone's, like, that's the messages you get, right? But I think when we sometimes have nursing parents, they become the default, both culturally, the way we're structured, but also just in the family, because nursing can be such a lovely tool. And then those other relationships don't have as much experience finding their tools and their ways of navigating those tricky situations. That is a matter of making space, right? Making space for that and building that.
And as much as, and this kind of goes back to what I said before, as much as you can be intentional about incorporating other people into the regular routine and building those relationships, there's also the fact that life will provide opportunities for them to have their own connections and bonds. And sometimes they're kind of thrown into the deep end, and there might be a lot of feels at that very beginning kind of piece. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that if that caregiver, whether it's dad or auntie or grandma or, you know, a good friend or a neighbor or whomever it is, if they can navigate within their own internal experience, the things that are coming up for them, the stories that are coming up for them when that child is crying, if they can navigate that, find security in themselves, they will be able to co-regulate with that child. And that co-regulation is what's going to create the bonds. And they will be able to find the tools that are going to work for them. Mom doesn't have to leave a list of, these are the things that, you know, you can try with the child. She doesn't have to carry all that emotional labor and mental load, which is what, when we're talking about being intentional or like incorporating, sometimes it feels like that. And that's where moms, I feel like, get tripped up a lot. It's just like, I don't want to have to teach so-and-so how to parent my child, right? It's just easier if I do it. But then we can also get caught in this loop and the scary kind of feeling of, well, if I never teach them, they're never going to be able to do it, which just isn't true.
Well, and I like to tell a lot of my clients when we're talking about, you know, gradually bringing partner, co-parent, dad into bedtime or something like that, or sleep support or other caregivers, but that, like, to a certain extent, almost always mom, but it doesn't have to be. It's not always, but mostly it is. Like, it's not your emotional labor to carry, but also, like, what works for you is not necessarily what's going to work for someone else. So you may not be able to even make a list that's going to work. So it's helpful to be like, oh, what things does this kiddo generally find soothing? What does their nervous system, you know, respond well to? And also, there's nothing like learning and then figuring it out. And that, like you were saying, the stories and the confidence, the security in yourself, it's that confidence in, like, we can do this, we can get through it, and we will figure it out. It's so powerful.
Yeah, I feel like I could go down like a huge rabbit hole with that, because that's my jam. I love talking about that.
I need to have you back on to talk about that, because it's a whole different conversation. We would absolutely love to dig into. I wanted to just kind of bring it back, though, to some of the ways that nursing can be a really lovely parenting tool. You know, I feel like we've navigated some of the ways it gets scapegoated, and some of the ways can be challenging, and some of the just the dynamics and the pressures. But I know that I found personally, and a lot of the parents I support through sleep and through the lately type stuff, it can be a really wonderful parenting tool, right? Of connection and reconnection and meltdowns and all the things. And so I'd love, from your experience, personally and professionally, you want to kind of speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. So when we're talking about, like, if we start with even meltdowns and the sensory piece, so anything like midline input on the body is going to be particularly soothing and, like, very stimulating for the nervous system and soothing. So sucking is hugely soothing and regulating for particularly young humans, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that. And when we're talking about the nervous system, we're talking about stressors. We're talking about, the body going to like a state of arousal, which it will when it senses a threat is nearby or danger. And mm-hmm. So in the context of sleep, we can talk about, the necessity for proximity in order for that nervous system to feel regulated, because it kind of takes off that pressure of constantly being alert for a threat, right? And needing to cry out and signal for that. And then when we're talking about breastfeeding, the fact that you're breastfeeding, the fact that that child is breastfeeding means that the parent is close. They can only do that in proximity. So even simply from that fact, the fact that the parent's close by, that in and of itself is incredibly reassuring for the child. And so moving into talking about attachment theory too, and then neuroscience and the way that the brain develops, but your child, it's important for human children to know that their world that they're in is safe. Mm-hmm. And that will wire their brain for safety. That will wire their brain to be able to do all of the other things that it needs to do to learn and to play and all those things, because it's not stuck on constantly scanning for a threat. We can look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like if those basic needs aren't being met, then they're not going to be able to advance to those other stages. But a lot of times as parents, we get this kind of narrative in our head that our child needs to learn to be independent. And so we almost want to throw them into a state of feeling fearful, of feeling like there could be threats around, because somehow that's going to teach them, survival skills. But really, we don't want our child in a state of survival mode. We want our child in a state of relaxation, of calm, because it's from that state that they can experiment, that they can play. I think of Deborah McNamara's book, Rest, Play, Grow, right? The play and the grow come from the rest, right? It's so important. Yes. So there's all those pieces. So the actual physical sensory input of breastfeeding, whether that's the oral, like sucking, but also the proximity, the physical touch of the parent can do a lot for the body on a very like biophysical level, as well as the more emotional, piece of understanding that your parent is close and can protect you. So there's that. Then there's immunological factors, of course. So we know that the immune system doesn't fully develop until somewhere between ages 2 and 7. It depends on the research that you're looking at. But coincidentally, children that are self-weaning will often self-wean between ages 2 and 7. Well, I wonder why, right?
So funny that, huh?
Children need the immune support from breast milk. And I, of course, there's many children that are alive and well who have not breastfed. And I understand that, but there are important differences and there's important support that breast milk offers during that time. So we also know that breast milk adapts and changes from an immunological standpoint during that time, over time. So we know that as the volume of milk decreases, the concentration of certain immunological factors increases, which means that even, so many times parents are like, oh, they're just breastfeeding for comfort. And first of all, there's nothing, just comfort doesn't exist. Comfort is a very valid and important piece that we can talk about. And I kind of just did, but also just getting drops during that time, they're powerful drops that have a lot of, perhaps not as much nutritional value, but they have a ton of immunological value and importance during that time. So even just a few drops can make a big impact in a toddler's immune system.
Especially when they're like licking the grocery store floor and eating dirt off the sidewalk. I mean, that's good for their immune system too, but we want those lovely sneezing right in somebody else's face, classic toddler antics. We want those immune boosting, bioactive cells if we can get them.
Of course. So so there's all that immune support. And then there is nutritional support. Yeah. Breast milk continues to be a really important piece of a toddler's nutrition well into the second year of life and beyond. We know that in that second year of life, about, I think it was 450 milliliters of breast milk done from a study that was done, I think in 2001, gives about a third of the energy requirements of the day. It's almost half of the protein requirements. Mm-hmm. 95 or 94% of the vitamin B12 requirements and 60% of vitamin C requirements. So there is tons of nutritional you know, value in that breast milk, even in the second year of life. And so often I see parents that are like, my child would rather breastfeed than eat solid foods. This is a problem. I'm going to bring it up to my pediatrician and have this whole conversation because we think that solid foods are just so, so important. They are. Don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't offer your child solid foods. And of course, if your child is not eating solid foods at all, then you may want to talk to a dietitian, but hopefully somebody who... hopefully somebody who has, a dietitian, a feeding therapist, you know, so many different options there, your pediatrician, of course. And also, it's really normal for kids to still prefer breast milk to solid foods in that first year, in that second year of life still. And to be breastfeeding what feels like around the clock, that's okay. There's so many, and to ebb and flow, of course, with it. So there might be times where, you know, teething, of course, but developmental things, new situations that are happening, like starting a daycare, like, you know, having a new sibling, moving, all of those things where a child's just going to breastfeed more and they might not be taking as much solid foods during that time. And that's okay. We also know that it's normal and common in many Western places to have the recommendation of cow's milk given for that second year of life. And the reason is because it's actually difficult for a tiny little tummy to get enough nutrients out of solid foods alone, and they need liquid nutrition. Of course, human milk is absolutely preferable to baby cow milk when we're talking about human babies.
Absolutely. I know my oldest is still a very selective eater, and like I bet it's the same study. Like I remember reading that when he was, 14 or 15 months, something in that early second year, and being like, awesome, this kid's delicious all the time. Good thing that's filling in the nutritional gaps. And I'm like, and we don't have to worry about cow's milk because he nurses plenty. And being so like relieved because he's very selective eater, still is. And, you know, that's a whole different journey and conversation. But it was so nice then to know like those nutritional gaps are getting really filled in quite well from nursing.
And the breast milk changes, like as much as it changes with the immunological factors, if there's an increase in protein and fat during that second year of life too. So it's adapting to meet those nutritional gaps as well.
I know, it's so cool. I'll say like my favorite thing about nursing was it as a reconnection tool, which I think speaks to all of the things you were saying about like the regulation, right? And the sensory piece and that nervous system support. And, you know, for both my kiddos, found that in the toddler years, it was like the best thing when we were separated or like there was a really busy day. And that was a reconnection ritual for a really long time. It was just like, we're going to plop on the couch or wherever and snuggle and nurse. And, you know, I'm so lucky that my husband was very supportive of that and always made space. Like he really valued that and that space and made that like really easy for us to do. And so that was like our thing for, I don't know, definitely in the ones and the twos, you know, maybe not the entire time I was nursing them, but for a very large portion of it. That was a big thing for us.
Yeah. And I think that as much as it can be a reconnection tool that we want to facilitate as parents and that we're looking forward to, it's a reconnection tool for the child too.
Yep, so both ways.
A lot of times when they're asking for it, it could be, you know, that they're looking for immune support. Their body's signaling them to do that. It could be nutrition. It also could be connection. And not that I want to deep dive this because I could, but something that I talk about is what I call this toddler breastfeeding stress cycle, where because of the internalized narratives that we have about toddler breastfeeding, as well as other things too, nursing aversion, et cetera, but we can feel this stress when our child goes to latch or stress around breastfeeding, whether it's consciously or unconsciously. And we can be projecting these cues of danger really and threat to our child. And that happens in a physiological way. So even just the tightness of our jaw, the way our eyes are opening, the tone of our voice, you know, our body tension, and that can all feel a little bit scary to a toddler. They might not have the intellectual ability to understand it or to articulate it, but on a physiological level, they're picking up on those cues because we all have something like called neuroception, where our brain is scanning our environment for cues of safety and danger. So when we are not feeling super safe about breastfeeding, so we're getting these stories, uh-oh, this means, for example, perhaps, you know, you've got a trip coming up in a few months and you know that you're going to be away for a night. And so then when your toddler goes to breastfeed all the time, in your head, you're thinking, uh-oh, this is going to be bad. I need to start putting a lot of boundaries up right now. And we need to wean so that my child can, you know, be okay without us, or so that my mom will be able to watch him overnight or whatever. Mm-hmm. As we're thinking those thoughts, our body is getting tense and our eyes are getting wide and we're starting to get stressed out. And what does our child see? They don't see the thoughts. They see all of that stress and they want to connect with us. We are their safe place. So when they see that, they're going to cue to feed more often than not. Now they might not. I have lots of podcasts where I go into this in more detail, but what I often see happening is there's an increase in frequency of asking because they're looking to connect with us. And from a biological standpoint, you know, breastfeeding is going to cause oxytocin to flow for us too. So it's not just our best tool in meeting their needs, but it's their best tool in meeting their own needs and in preserving and protecting their relationship with us. Yeah. They don't know that they live in a world where the fact that they're breastfeeding inherently is stressful for us. They don't know that from a biological standpoint. They're like, no, I need to feel close to you. And their body is very wise and knows that when they feel close to us, we feel close to them. And it's actually soothing for us. So it's literally like they're trying to regulate us too. But of course, we get stuck in the spiral, the cycle where their frequency in asking will trigger us more. And our being triggered will trigger them more and cause them to ask more. We can get stuck in this loop and in this spiral. So that's something I see a lot too.
And as with everything in parenting, I feel like I talk about this a lot in sleep. Starting with our own self-regulation is the starting point, right? And that's so true in the example you just gave, in so many sleep situations that are stressful, in so many parenting situations with big kids, you know, starting with taking care of our own nervous system and self-regulation.
I have a free guide that I go into like more how to do that kind of piece. So it's how to say no to the feed while still saying yes to the need. And it really does start. What I start with my, like within the guide is really deciding on what your heart message is. So it's like, what do you always want to be conveying to your child? And that in and of itself is inherently regulating for us, right? Mm-hmm. When we're, you know, you might see those little tips on Instagram to like, look at your child's hand when you're starting to get angry and notice how small it is or smell their head. And all of these things are going to be regulating for us and fostering that connection. But just coming back to starting there with your heart message, what is it that I always want my child to know, right? That they're safe, that I love them unconditionally, whatever that is, and it's going to be unique for you, the way that it expresses, and it's going to resonate. And then from there, you can identify the needs, you can identify your yes and your no. And then I break down how to articulate those in different ways of communication. So some of it's verbal, some of it's with your body language, your actions, all that kind of stuff. So that's all within the guide there too. But
And we'll link that in the show notes so that they can access it, because that sounds so awesome. On that note, as we wrap up, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you? And we'll have links to things, of course, in the show notes for them. Because I know there's so much overlap in the work that you and I do, that it's such a great pairing together.
Yeah, I love that too. So my website is ownyourparentingstory.com. And from there, you can kind of find all the things if you need to. But I'm also on Instagram at own.your.parenting.story. And I have my free guide, like I said, which is Making Changes, How to Say No to the Feed While Still Saying Yes to the Need. And you can get that at ownyourparentingstory.com/guide. And I do have like a free training on my website, like a free workshop. And I have my big group coaching program, which is like a curriculum-based group coaching program, where I facilitate and support parents to make those changes in their breastfeeding relationship, whether that's fully weaning, making changes around nighttime breastfeeds, daytime breastfeeds, or tandem feeding, bringing in another nursling into your dyad, making it a triad. But I support parents with all that kind of wonderful stuff within my big group coaching program too. So you can find all those details on my website.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. I have loved this conversation, and I'm sure we'll have other ones in the future. So thank you so much for being on this episode today.
My pleasure, Kim.
Thank you for joining me today. I hope this episode left you feeling more informed, confident, and encouraged on your sleep journey. And just a reminder before you go that nothing in this episode is individualized to your specific sleep situation, nor is it to be taken as medical advice. Take what resonates, ignore what doesn't, and check with your healthcare provider about any medical concerns. Take a moment to subscribe to this podcast so that you'll never miss an episode. And take a moment to rate, review, or share an episode you love on social media. All of that helps parents just like you find me, this podcast, and this gentle and responsive sleep information. I'll see you next time.